You're listening to the Disability Law Show on the Bell Talk Radio Network.
And again, good afternoon. A couple minutes after 1 o'clock on a chilly Saturday, big time. This is a binge-watching TV, listen to the Disability Law Show type of day. So there you go. James Fireman is here. He is a partner with Tamara Gopian Partners, Sanfiru Tamarkin, LLP, right there, the most positively reviewed disability law firm from coast to coast to coast. So you're in good hands for the next hour. Reaching out to call in live to the show, 416-872-1010. Text is 71010 as well. Any questions here and now can be put forth. Those two methods. Email also works. We try to get to some of those throughout the show. help@disabilityrights.ca. And if you have any other questions pertaining to long-term disability, you want to do your own asking of questions without coming on air, you can type it into a website called mydisabilityquestions.com, or you can search for other questions similar to yours as well. But we'll get to all that a little later on. We always got a few things off the top to discuss, guys. James, Tamar, welcome. Good to be with you guys again this weekend. I don't know who's going to go first, but you guys can have at her, as they say. How are you?
Good.
Doing
good.
Well, pal. Doing well.
Good.
So,
good.
You know, I know we try and keep things topical on the show, but I want to talk about an issue that probably doesn't get enough airtime. It's a little bit under the radar, and that, of course, is COVID. We like to be on the cutting edge.
Never heard of
it. Go where other people aren't going. Okay, but in all seriousness, we had a lady contact us this week, and she is being asked by her insurer to attend a third-party IME, an independent medical evaluation. And as part of that, the insurer has asked about her vaccination status. And the issue is that she was exposed. She hasn't actually tested positive, or isn't sure anyway, because there's difficulty in getting PCR tests, which is a whole other issue. But she has been exposed. And as you know, the protocols are different depending on whether you've been vaccinated or not. And so she wanted to know whether she has to disclose her vaccination status to her insurer. It's an interesting question, and there isn't a clear answer to it. I'll start with that. It's not an issue, as far as I know, that has been before the courts, whether an insurer is entitled to inquire about someone's COVID vaccination status. Now, initially, when I think about this issue, you know, the answer is, well, someone's vaccination status has nothing to do with the test for disability, whether or not they are disabled from their own occupation or from any occupation after 2 years. But it is relevant to some extent, and in this particular context, if the insurer is asking for her to see a licensed qualified doctor for an assessment, which they are entitled to do, and she is not able to go because she says she's been exposed, there is at least an argument, I think, that the insurer has, that they are entitled to know what her status is, and as a result, what the parameters are on her requirement to self-isolate. In other words, when they might be able to get this assessment back up and running. I don't know what the answer is at the end of the day, but obviously she didn't want to reveal her vaccination status. And so my advice is, generally, first and foremost, if you're not too concerned about it one way or another, I would let them know. I wouldn't be too concerned about what they're going to do with it. I think the purpose in this case is pretty clear, but I appreciate that a lot of people aren't so trusting, especially with the private information, and that's completely fair, of course, too. And so if you are sort of stuck in this situation, my advice in this case was that as an alternative, she could go to her doctor, who has told her she has to isolate, and her doctor can say that she has been exposed and she is being required to self-isolate and expects that she will be able to, as long as she has no symptoms, will be able to attend a IME on such and such a date. That's the best that I could come up with. Now, I'm curious, Tamar, whether there is something else that you would have added.
No, James, it's a really interesting situation. I don't know if you can add much more to the picture. I guess what came to mind and when I was thinking about it as you were describing it was whether she would have passed the pre-screening. So like I took my son to the eye doctor today and we had a pre-screening. We had to go through a series of questions and they did ask about vaccination status. And I don't want to get into whether they should have or shouldn't have, but I would have expected that even the IME provider, so the doctor or wherever it is that this individual is attending, would have a similar screening. And so she's not going to pass the screening regardless. In other words, that she's been in close contact and has been told to isolate. I think it makes sense in the circumstances to just simply advise the insurer or the IME provider that that's the situation without necessarily having to go so far as to disclose the vaccination status. No. I completely agree with you, James, that most insurers will require some kind of medical support for that. In other words, if you are not going to be able to attend or if there's some reason why you cannot attend, you know, you would like a bit of an endorsement from a doctor to do so, so that you're not being put in a position where the insurer is saying, look, you're not being compliant, right? That's the biggest issue here is, so let's play this out. You know, she doesn't disclose her vaccination status. She does not attend the IME because she's been told to isolate. It doesn't sound like that's the situation, but let's take it to the extreme. Then what would be the consequence to that from the insurer's perspective? The only thing they could really raise in my mind is that there's a non-compliance issue. But it goes back to what's reasonable. So is it reasonable in the circumstances for her not to attend? If she's got medical support that she should isolate, absolutely it's reasonable for her not to attend. But in order to sort of go so far as to disclose the vaccination status, I don't know if it's incumbent on her to do so unless there's a specific pre-screening. And even then, you got to wonder whether that's in the realm of acceptable or reasonable in the circumstances.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think, strictly speaking, they're entitled to that information. But my concern was more pragmatic than anything. I mean, I think ultimately, were this to land in front of a judge, if the insurer took a very hard-line decision and said, no, you got to disclose it to us, otherwise we assume that you're okay and you have to attend, and then cut you off for non-compliance, I don't think a judge would listen to that. I don't think that would stand up in court. I'm not terribly concerned about that. My bigger concern is, in the short term, keeping this person on benefits, on claim. You know, not having to go through that rigmarole. That's obviously a much better result for the client. And so from a practical standpoint, what can you do? Well, I mean, we both discussed it, and I think landed more or less on the same place. So I don't know that there's much more than that. My first and foremost, I would say, unless you have a big issue with it, though, I think it's just easier to disclose it. If you do have a big issue, then you want to make sure that you've provided that medical support so that at the very least, the insurer can't take the position that you're refusing to attend for no medical reason.
Guys, the phone number right here and now if you have questions. It is, as you know, 416-872-1010. Text as well to reach us during the remainder of the hour, 71010 as well. Help at disabilityrights.ca is the way to do that. So where do you guys want to take this? Tamar, you got something you want to bring up?
Yeah, if you wouldn't mind, guys,
I've got something
that's coming up. I've got a mediation coming up next week, and I wanted to talk about a topic that we don't talk a lot about, and I'm always interested to hear, you know, how these sort of conversations play themselves out. And I would say it's sort of a classic and a goodie, which is, you know, I've got a client who was declined long-term disability benefits after the change of definition. So for those who might just be tuning in and wondering what is the change of definition, most of these disability policies, as we know, have the initial 2 years typically is one test, which is, are you totally disabled from doing the essential duties of your occupation due to your health? And if your health prevents you from doing your occupation, then you should be qualifying for long-term disability benefits under the disability policy. But after those 2 years, and usually the decision is made even before the two-year mark, the insurance company is going to be looking to see whether or not you're going to continue to qualify for disability benefits after the definition changes to qualify. And the test changes and arguably becomes tougher to meet, and it says, are you totally disabled from doing any occupation, anything in the world, for which you've got education, training, and experience, and which would give you roughly what we call a commensurate wage, or basically the amount that you're receiving for long-term disability benefits. We know that's usually generally two-thirds of what you're making. And so in my client's situation, he was actually approved and paid for the full 2 years, and he was actually approved and paid beyond those 2 years. They actually issued a letter saying, we believe that you are totally disabled from any occupation. And within about 4 months of that agreement that he was totally disabled from any occupation, the insurance company did a complete 180 based on a misinterpretation of the family doctor's note saying, you know, I'm encouraging my patient to consider other occupations. And they interpreted that, the insurance company interpreted that to mean that he can work, and they decided to cut off his benefits. No further assessment internally on the medical information. Nothing else was done. They just simply said, we're doing a 180 and we're just going to decline your benefits. So I'm up in a lather now, preparing this brief, looking forward to the mediation memo. And of course, I'm interested to hear what James has to say. In my mind, when they pay you beyond the own occupation period, it's a very, very tough situation for the insurer to be, to then stand up before a court and say, no, but we're saying differently now, because of course we're looking at 15, 20 years of benefits to pay this guy and we want him off claim. What do you think, James?
Well, I think I agree with you generally. You know what, we only have a little bit of time before the break.
Sure.
So there's a bit of me to dig into here. So why don't we pick this up when we're back and we can get the ball rolling then.
Sounds good.
We will do exactly that. Give you some time to grab a phone or a keypad or your phone or whatever you want to do. You can phone it in 416-872-1010, or you can text. Always an option, 71010 as well. Your questions for Tamar or James. We'll take that short break. Get right back to it. It is the Disability Law Show on the Bell Talk Radio Network.
You're listening to the Disability Law Show on the Bell Talk Radio Network.
It is 1:20. Welcome back to the show. Good to have you along on a frigid Saturday. It's a good time to brush up in your disability law rights and things you should know. So gather around the warm fire of the radio, because you're going to need it. Here, James and Tamar, both partners, Sanfiru Tamarkin LLP. They have helped thousands of people across this country get the compensation they deserve. You want to reach out? You should do so, if only for a chilled out conversation. Here is how you do it. 1-855-821-5900. Help at disabilityrights.ca as well. We'll get to our first phone call for the afternoon. John, stand by. We'll get to you, big fella. But first, James, you just wanted to bookend what we were talking about before, right? Go ahead.
Sure. Tamar had been talking about a mediation of hers that's coming up, where her client had been approved beyond the two-year change of definition, meaning the insurer has accepted that this client is disabled from any occupation qualified by training, education, experience, and then shortly after changed their tune because a doctor's note, sort of opaquely referred to the possibility of looking at other employment, which doesn't necessarily mean anything other than that they're no longer able to do what they had been doing before. And so the insurer had run with that. What I think I would make sure of, and I have no doubt Tamar's done this, is that the client gets a letter from the doctor clarifying exactly what they meant and ensuring that there is absolutely no ambiguity about what the doctor believes is the capability of their patient. And it puts a fine point on what their functional abilities are and the extent to which this is going to prevent them from being able to work. Once you've done that, in conjunction with what Tamar was talking about, that after the two-year change of definition, if they've accepted you, the case gets much harder for the insurer. I think that would be a very difficult case for the insurer to defend. As long as you have that medical support after the 2 years, it's going to be very tough. Anyway, why don't we get to John, who has been patiently waiting to speak with us.
You bet. John, thanks for hanging on. How are you today?
Okay, how are you? I understand that I learned from my teachers that we do live in a world of illusion and facade and weasel words and lots of semantics in a time of great deception. My mother taught me, like my grandmother, to look before you leap. Don't just leap. And as I made up a saying at age 16, let the fool jump first and learn from other people's mistakes. As my law teacher said, those who never learn from history are condemned to repeat history again. And the Bible says that as well, by the way. For the two on panel there, my question is, after me hearing, and I don't believe in hearsay, but these are people I know, they called up their insurance companies and they were told that if they took the needle that they would be cut off from their life insurance. Does that also apply to work insurance? You know, if it applies to both, and if there are any, just let me know what you think about that or what your knowledge is with regards to that exit. Thank you.
Sorry, I want to be sure that we're answering the right question here, John. So your question is about the COVID vaccine. And is your question about what happens if you do take it or what happens if you don't as it relates to your insurance?
If one takes the needle, are they cut off from their insurance benefits, both life insurance and or work insurance?
I can tell you I have never heard of anything suggesting that you would be cut off from your benefits for taking the COVID vaccine. There would have to be, for that to happen, it would have to be viewed as, something experimental, you taking on a hugely unnecessary risk. And right now, the public health is telling everyone to get the vaccine. So taking the vaccine, I can't imagine a scenario where that would have an impact on your access to your insurance, whether it's disability insurance or extended health. If you don't take it, it shouldn't change that either, unless there's something specific in your policy that speaks to that. And most of the policies out there were written before there was a vaccine, in fact, before COVID was something anyone was aware of. So I wouldn't think that there is anything in any of the policies that would specifically speak to that. There are more gray areas when you get to situations where refusing to take the vaccine impedes your ability to work. It can also be an issue if your refusal to take the vaccine or COVID in general is causing mental health issues. But that's a matter of eligibility, or not eligibility, that's a matter of whether or not you would actually pass the test. And I think what John is asking about is whether it would actually void the insurance. And the answer, as far as I know, is that it is no. I can't think of a scenario where it would. Tamar, anything that you have to add there?
Yeah, I would say two things. I agree with James. Number one, usually the continuation of your benefits package, and I think John's talking about beyond just disabilities and life and other coverages, are usually tied to your employment to begin with. And so we can talk about that on another show, but usually whether you get it or don't get it, I mean, it's tied to your employment and, is there a vaccine mandate at work? Who knows? So I agree with James, there's some gray area around that. But life insurance in particular, usually when you apply, you have to go through a series of questions. They will do like an inquiry about your health usually in order to get life insurance. And that starts out at the beginning of any sort of coverage. And so I haven't heard of the life insurance coverage actually including anything about vaccine status. I'd be surprised. If anyone's heard of that, I'd be interested to hear. But generally, they're talking about, have you had a history of heart condition? Do you have a family history of other significant health issues? That's usually the screening that's required in order to, basically be in good health in order to apply and get life insurance. And so what I've been told is that you obviously don't want to misrepresent your health status on a form like that.
I have no doubt that our pal Terry Corcoran is listening, and I expect he is probably going to be texting me at the break if he has any input. We need a Terry Corcoran bat signal or something like that. Of course,
yeah.
we really don't. It's actually called the radio.
Awesome.
And him listening. In any case, John, I hope that answered your question. And I guess we got some time for some emails before the break.
Yeah, we'll slide into one here. First one, Lydia chimes in. Lydia, again, it's help@disabilityrights.ca. Appreciate the time. Says, I have not provided consent to my insurance company to communicate with Service Canada regarding the status of my CPP disability application. They're threatening to deduct the max amount I would be eligible to receive. Can they communicate with Service Canada without my consent? What are my obligations?
James, I'm going to jump in, okay? Because this consent thing really bugs me. There's one insurer in particular who, so they'll send a package out. They'll send a letter out saying, okay, we would like you to apply for CPP disability benefits. And they will characterize it that there is a requirement for you to apply for CPP disability benefits. Mm-hmm. And they will include in this package a consent form allowing the insurer to communicate directly with CPP. And my view of it is, I'm not sure they're allowed to do that necessarily. The policy doesn't say anything about a requirement to apply or a requirement to provide the consent. But there's some more practical considerations to this, which is, it might be easier for you if you're going to apply for CPP disability. It might just be easier to have that communication directly between the insurer and CPP, partly because the policy does allow, usually most disability insurers, to deduct what you receive if you are granted CPP disability. And so the whole payment process and ensuring that the insurance company gets their pound of flesh for that CPP disability might just be easier if you've got that, you know, direct communication. But in terms of what the bounds of that communication is, I mean, I'd want some of that to come from myself if I'm the one who's the disability claimant. For example, what medical information perhaps that I've submitted to the insurance company in support of my disability claim. But at the end of the day, I think what Lydia should understand is that the policies typically read that we can either estimate it if we think you're eligible for it, or we will deduct it if you are approved for it. And so, you know, the tough part is that, yes, there's no requirement to apply, but certainly if they're going to estimate it, then you would like to apply most likely, because if you're not approved, then you can go back to the insurance and say, look, I'm not approved. You shouldn't be estimating this.
Right.
So that's certainly a consideration. But look, I've got to wonder whether maybe James wants to chime into this. And I know we're getting close to our break time, so maybe we pick this up after our next break.
We'll do exactly that. So stand by again. Any more phone calls and emails, you can join the show. We'd love to have you here. 416-872-1010. Phone number, text 71010 as well. And that email Lydia used, and you can use anytime, even when the show's not on air. That would be help@disabilityrights.ca. We'll continue Disability Law Show on the Bell Talk Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Disability Law Show on the Bell Talk Radio Network.
You bet. Welcome back. You could still call in. You got time. 416-872-1010 and 71010 is the text number to get a hold of us here for the remainder of the hour. James Fireman, Tamara Gobian Partners, Sanfiru Tamarkin LLP, reach out. Get the compensation you deserve from the most positively reviewed disability law firm in the country. No kidding there. That's pretty good props, but it's all true. Guys, where do you want to go? Tamara, you had to finish something up before we get on to another question or email, right?
I believe I was going to jump
okay.
in, actually. We had Lydia's email before the break, and Tamar had explained the issues around CPP applications and the extent to which your insurer can compel you to do that and compel you to provide your consent for them to communicate directly with CPP disability.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I wanted to emphasize, which Tamar did on the way out, is that ultimately you really want to make sure that you are making that application in whichever form it happens, because your insurer is entitled in almost all cases to take a credit for your CPP disability. And if you don't apply, to take a credit for the estimated amount that you would receive. That's certainly the position they'll take if you don't. So you want to make sure that you've applied one way or the other. If you don't want to give your consent, fine, but make sure you get all that information, as Tamar said. But here's one thing that I will point out to you. As much as there should be a healthy level of distrust and skepticism around all interactions with insurers, the one time when they really actually are in your corner is when it comes to your CPP application. They want you to get approved.
Right.
If they're paying you benefits, they want you to be approved for CPP disability, because that is lessening the amount that they have to pay each month. So I wouldn't expect them to be undermining you in any way in that application. But nonetheless, I can still appreciate why you might want to control that communication yourself. And if you do, that's perfectly fine. Just make sure it is complete. Before we move on to our next email, we had in the last segment also spoken with the caller, John, who had questions about what would happen if you refused a COVID vaccine and what impact that might have on your insurance. And I had mentioned our friend Terry Corcoran, who, for those not familiar, is a longtime veteran of the insurance industry and quite recently just turned 70, so we'll wish Terry a happy birthday. And I'd asked whether he might chime in over the break, and of course he did, and in doing so revealed, of course, all 70 years. He wrote, from a medical underwriting standpoint, I've never seen a requirement to be vaccinated for anything to get coverage, not even back when polio was around. That's a direct quote. So thank you, Terry, for that. It is greatly appreciated, as always.
Awesome. Guys, question tomorrow, James. Can disability insurance or private investigators, because everybody loves those when it's on their tail, can they legally get access to texts, emails, phone records, and all that stuff in a lawsuit?
Yeah, let me pick this one up. So I want to answer this narrowly and then a little bit more broadly. So the question right now is just talking about text, emails, and phone records. And generally speaking, no. Unless you've sent those to the insurer, of course, then they will have direct access to it. But there shouldn't be any other reason why your insurer would be able to get access to that. And if they hired an investigator and the investigator somehow hacked into your text, email, or phone records, that would be a huge privacy violation. And that would be a huge issue for the investigator. And if the insurer had knowledge of it and didn't do anything about it and didn't reveal that to their insurer that their investigator had gone rogue, so to speak, then they would probably be in a fair bit of trouble as well. It isn't something that you see typically. Now, I will say that when I used to do a lot more personal injury, there were discrete circumstances where some of that information might have to be produced in the context of a lawsuit, but I don't think it would ever apply in disability. And just to give you an example, so in a motor vehicle case, for example, there's always a concern with whether someone is on the phone or texting while they are driving and if that mm-hmm. led to the accident. And so to the extent that you can narrow the records to, you know, maybe 20 minutes before and 20 minutes after the accident happened, because it's difficult to pinpoint the precise time, sometimes it is a reasonable request to produce phone records or text records from that precise timeline to show whether or not you were in fact on the phone at that time. I can't see a scenario where that would be relevant in a disability case, but I won't preclude any possibility because I'm sure there are scenarios that just aren't occurring to me. But save and except for that, I wouldn't think that that's ever something that would be producible. Now, on the other hand, more broadly speaking, is social media, which, first of all, is often freely available to the public at large if you aren't taking measures to protect your information and what you're posting on the various social media sites. So I would, first of all, recommend that you do that. There are certainly cases where investigators will, you know, make fake accounts and see if they can get access that way by asking to friend you. And it's
wow.
It's questionable ethically whether they can do that or not. But if you allow access to someone you don't know, I mean, if they're posing as someone else, if they're creating an identity and purposely posing as somebody else to trick you into doing it, that's one thing. If they were to, you know, create some fake identity but not really lie about who they were, and you just gave them access anyway, I don't know. I might still have a problem with it, but it's sort of, it's more of a gray area. But the point really is this: if you are involved in any kind of litigation, be smart. Be careful about anything that you're posting on social media. Certainly go back and check what your privacy settings are and be aware that in most social media, you have the ability to tag other people and to post information about other people, which means other people can do that to you. Unless you control that in your privacy settings, which you almost always can. You can limit the ability of anybody else to tag you in a post or in a photo, and you should be doing that. You should make sure that if you're involved in any sort of lawsuit, that information about you isn't going to be freely available to the other side. So that's really all I want to say. You still do want to be careful, but to answer the specific question, no, text, emails, and phone records are generally not something that you need to be too concerned about in the context of a disability lawsuit.
Tamara, you got something? Or that just pretty much covers it. What do you think?
Well, James, of course, did a fabulous job. I totally agree. The only add-on I will say is this. In the context of a legal claim, sometimes we're asked, you know, what information is going to be exchanged in the legal claim? you know, what can I expect the, you know, the lawsuit to bring up in terms of what I need to provide to support my legal claim? And the main thing that we guide our principals on as lawyers in the context of a legal claim is this relevant? It's an examination for discovery or scope of discovery type question. And, you know, that really is our guiding point in terms of the kind of information that gets exchanged between the insurance company and our client. Of course, we facilitate that. Of course, that is our part of our job, you know, in providing services for our clients, of course. You know, usually the focus is on medical information. But in this question, we talked about emails. And emails is an interesting one because I'm seeing more and more insurance companies and case managers and adjusters actually communicating with our clients and claimants via email. So could there be a scenario where emails are part of that discovery, part of what is relevant? And it could be if it's a situation, for example, where my client has said to me, look, they were communicating with me every 2 or 3 days. It was completely excessive. Mm-hmm. The emails they were sending me were aggressive or had, you know, improper content in it, or they misrepresented things, for example. Then in a scenario like that, absolutely, I want to produce emails. I want to get copies of my client's emails, the emails they were receive from the insurance company. And I want to make that as part of the record of the legal claim, because I'm going to use that information as a basis to argue that there was bad faith, that the insurance company didn't deal with my client in a good faith, transparent way, in a respectful way, in a way that wasn't harmful to either their health or their claim. So that's, you know, to sort of take this to the next level in the context of a legal claim, you know, relevance is a really, really important factor. And that's where I could see, you know, the door opening to disclosing things like that, but not unfettered, right? It's not like the investigator is going to do it, or the case manager is going to request it, or that you're obligated to necessarily produce it unless the insurance company can establish on their end that it's relevant as well.
Yeah, and to be totally clear, the emails I was referring to were private emails, not involving the insurer. Definitely. Any email involving the insurer is producible for sure.
We'll take a short break, guys. Give you time to grab a pen or a you know, your keypad or a phone for that matter. Reach out and ask a question if you so desire. 416-872-1010 is the way to make that call here for the remainder of the show. 71010 is the text number, and help at disabilityrights.ca. Duncan, thank you for the email. We'll get to yours as soon as we come back from the break, and we'll do that momentarily. Lots more Disability Law Show is on the way. The Bell Talk Radio Network.
Disability Law Show continues on the Bell Talk Radio Network.
It sure does. It is 1:50 Saturday afternoon. Welcome to it. James Fireman, Tamara Gopi, and Samfiru Tamarkin LLP, both partners in this amazing law firm that has helped tens of thousands of Canadians across this country get the compensation deserved. How about that? Reaching out. Easy. 1-855-821-5900. Just have a good chat with either of them or a member of their crew. They will be glad to take care of you and have a conversation with you. Help at disabilityrights.ca as well. Want to move on to Duncan, who emailed shortly a short time ago and promised would we get to it. Duncan says, hello guys, I've been on LTD for over 2 years, and last month my insurance company labeled me totally disabled. They recently informed me that I need to apply for CPPD. I'm not sure why I have to do that, but my question is, can the insurance company cut me off if CPP rejects my application? Duncan's been listening. Would a disability lawyer like you guys be able to help me if this happens? Thank you very much. Where else?
Well, let me take this one. So we addressed a lot of this when we were talking mm-hmm. about Lydia's question earlier, which was also involving CPP disability. Just so everyone understands, if you're listening, so your private disability insurer pays you your monthly LTD benefits, but within almost all of those policies, there is going to be a provision that says that if you are eligible, you have to apply for a CPP disability, and they get credit for whatever you are approved for. And if you don't apply, they're going to be able to take what they estimate you would have gotten approved for had you done so. CPP disability is available to anybody who is paying into CPP and passes the test for CPP disability. Now, this is where it gets interesting in terms of Duncan's question, because Duncan is asking, if you apply for CPP disability, as the insurer is saying that he has to, and if he gets rejected, can the insurer use that as a basis to cut him off? Well, the test for CPP disability and the test for LTD are different. LTD requires you to have a disability that's preventing you from doing your own occupation or beyond 2 years, any occupation that you're qualified for by training, education, or experience. CPP disability requires a severe and prolonged disability. That is a more onerous test than the LTD test. So if you are approved for CPP disability, it follows that you should, in every case, also be entitled to get your long-term disability benefits. But the opposite does not hold true. Because the CPP disability test is more onerous, even if they deny you for CPP disability, that does not mean that you are not qualified for LTD benefits. So if your insurer were to turn around and say, well, they denied you for CPP disability, therefore, and for that reason alone, we say you're no longer entitled to LTD, well, that would not be a defensible position. They might take that position anyway, because insurers sometimes take indefensible positions, but it wouldn't hold up. And so I can't promise you that a denial won't have a practical impact, but it shouldn't. And if they do cut you off, it is certainly something that we can challenge by a lawsuit. Before Tamar chimes in, or before we move along, I just want to bring up, there was someone who had called in and was asking about, you know, how to become a whistleblower. And the concern was that she knew someone who would go hunting once a year and presumably was getting disability benefits. Here's what I'm going to say to that. You know, if you know someone who's getting disability benefits and they're doing something that you think suggests that they're not disabled, what do you really know? What do you know about their disability? I mean, you might know part of it, but the vast majority of my clients have multiple different issues that they're dealing with. And over time, there also become psychological issues as well, too. So what you think you know about someone's disability may be pretty limited. But what do you know about what they're being told they can and can't do by their doctor? What do you know, you know, if their doctor is saying that they should go out and they should participate in activities as much as possible because it's good for them? And what do you know about their job to the extent that their functional abilities would allow them to do one thing like going hunting, but not necessarily their job? What does that necessarily say? My suggestion is that unless you have access to their entire medical and insurance file, stay out of it, because you don't know what you're talking about. You don't know what this person is going through. You don't know what their doctors have recommended. And why would you want to go out of your way in an attempt to hurt someone if you don't have all the information? I mean, it seems like, you know, an unkind thing to do for no particular purpose. Now, on the other hand, you know, sure, if you know someone is in fact working when they say that they're not, that's a different story. That's clearly someone who's being fraudulent. If you want to blow the whistle on them, have at it. I got no problem with that. But someone who's going out hunting, I mean, what are you doing? Like, what does that mean? How do you know what the significance of that is? That's really all I wanted to say. It was something that kind of bugged me a little bit when I saw the question. And I had told our board ops to not to take the question on the air. And I kind of regret not having done it, because I think it is something that would have been worthy of a conversation. So although my advice is, you know, I would just keep it to yourself in the circumstances, because what do you really know? I do regret not having taken the call. So if you're out there, I apologize, and you can feel free to call back on the next show and I will take it.
Want to move on to another email, guys? If you, I think we got time for one more. Let's go down to Will. I think we'll get Will in here. Says, guys, I want to communicate an email with my insurance due to stress and anxiousness. Is this legal, or can they cut me off my benefits? I do not want to make them angry and more difficult on me, but I get tirelessly stressed having to talk to them, and they seem to try to put words or try to make me agree to something when on the phone. What do I do?
It's an interesting question, Will. I think that you maintain some open and honesty, obviously, with the insurance company, and put it into context that they do have a job to do. And their job is to vet your disability claim, look at the forms, talk to you typically, ask you questions about what you're doing day to day, and then make an assessment or an evaluation as to whether or not you meet the tests under the policy to qualify for disability benefits. Look, with mental health claimants, it can be really, really difficult to navigate all of it. I think, you know, I've heard multiple clients say, look, the forms are overwhelming. Talking to my doctor is overwhelming. Obviously, getting the treatment that I need is overwhelming. That's all true. There are supports out there. And I think that the thing that bugs me a lot is if you don't apply, you don't get access to the benefits, though. And that is what you are remitting premiums for. And that is what the benefit policy is there for. And so, yes, it can be difficult. But by the same token, I want to sort of see it as a means to an end to provide the compensation that most people need at a time where it's really, really important, where they need to be focusing on their health, particularly their mental health. You want to have that lined up so that you are approved for those benefits. What do you think, James?
I mean, listen, I think you do what you have to do to get the benefits. Yeah. I don't disagree with anything that you said. And so, you know, sometimes that is going to create some stress and anxiety in your life. And that's, you know, the price that you pay for getting those benefits to a certain extent. You know, you can ask for anything reasonable, and you should do it in writing. But beyond that, I think you try and adjust your tolerance so that you get ultimately out of the relationship what you want, which is to get your benefits paid.
And with that, guys, we'll pretty much leave it there for an afternoon. Thank you so much if you've made a phone call or sent us an email like you're joining in the show. You can do it now. Continue to do so now that we're done, James and Tamar. You can get a hold of them, 1-855-821-5900 would be the number, the email address we use every show, and you can use anytime, help@disabilityrights.ca. And again, that website, free and anonymous. You want to ask your questions that way, and you can even search to see if your question has been asked previously. MyDisabilityQuestions.com. Really simple. Again, MyDisabilityQuestions.com. And we'll catch you next time. Disability Law Show, News Talk 1010.